I next met with Dr. Suzanne George to talk about the fascinating and complex world of gastrointestinal stromal tumors. And to begin, Dr. George provided a brief historical perspective of research progress in GIST.
We certainly understand so much more about GIST now than we ever had. The major findings came, as you know, back about 10 years ago with the understanding of GIST as a unique biologic entity, the importance of KIT in the disease as the really primary driver, where 85% of tumors harbor a mutation, activating mutation in KIT. And that really becomes the focal point for targeted therapies, KIT-directed therapies. And that led to the development of imatinib as first-line therapy and sunitinib as second-line therapy. I think that as the field has evolved more recently, really the challenges that we have are related to a couple of major points. One is resistance in GIST, where patients have a wonderful response to imatinib, but the median time to progression is about 2 years. And then sunitinib is the only standard approved second line therapy, and that can help about 60% of patients. But after sunitinib, again, resistance becomes a challenge, and we really need to understand and have better options for treating in that resistant population. The challenges, I think, in the field are understanding the heterogeneity, the biologic heterogeneity of resistance, where we're seeing secondary mutations in KIT. We're seeing within an individual patient, one may have multiple different secondary mutations present, even within an individual tumor. If folks are able to really dissect down within an individual tumor, you may find multiple resistance mutations within a specific tumor. And those are areas that are really being evaluated now to help us understand how we should approach resistance. I think there's also an interest in understanding the relevance of complementary pathways to KIT or upstream or downstream signaling. People are interested in looking at the role of HSP90 as a chaperone protein for KIT. People have looked at the AKT pathway, the role of mTOR within GIST. And I think that that's another area that we're trying to understand and hopefully be able to exploit for therapeutic benefit.
So question before we get to your cases, just again, kind of in terms of the biology, you've been talking about imatinib and sunitinib, and you're going to be talking about regorafenib, and maybe you can compare. I think I remember seeing some kind of Venn diagram in terms of how the three overlap in terms of the mutations. What do they have in common, and what do they have that are different?
So all drugs are multi-targeted kinase inhibitors. Imatinib is a relatively narrow spectrum, very potent inhibitor of KIT and PDGF receptor. And sunitinib includes KIT and PDGF receptor, but also broadens out into VEGF 1, 2, and 3, as well as hitting RET and perhaps some additional targets. Regorafenib includes many of the targets that sunitinib includes, but also will include FGF. And structurally, each one of these compounds is slightly different, so that although they hit many of the same targets, as you alluded to, if you look at the actual mutations, they may have slightly different potencies at the specific KIT mutation level. That's been looked at with imatinib and sunitinib. Both hit exon 11 mutations, both hit exon 9 mutations. Sunitinib may be a more potent exon 9 inhibitor. Regorafenib, the preclinical data for regorafenib is really still being developed. Regorafenib has been developed rather quickly, which is great, but some of that data has not yet been published. In the clinical trials, there certainly is suggestion of activity across the spectrum of mutations, including exon 11, exon 9. There was recently a paper published looking at sorafenib, which is structurally very similar to regorafenib, that suggested that a number of resistance mutations that are sunitinib and imatinib resistant actually are sensitive to sorafenib. And the suggestion may be, although this work is ongoing, that regorafenib may have a similar profile, again, with this broader extent of inhibition, although that data has not yet been formally presented or published.
Yeah, of course, we've been talking a lot recently about regorafenib and colorectal cancer. Your colleague, Charlie Fuchs, is with us recently where we were sort of brainstorming about this, and they brought up the fact how similar it is to sorafenib. Has sorafenib actually been used clinically in trials in GIST?
Yep, there have been at least two phase two trials of sorafenib and GIST, one that was done in the U.S. and one that was an Asian study. They both showed clinical benefit rates, including stable disease, of upwards of 50% with median progression-free survival in the five-month range. The toxicity was as expected, nothing unique in the GIST population, very similar to what's been seen in other tumor types. So, yep, it certainly has been, but the further development has gone more with regorafenib, as you know. I think the thought is that it's, again, very similar to sorafenib, maybe slightly more potent with some of its targets.
Have you yourself, I mean, sorafenib is available, and have you yourself ever used sorafenib in a patient with GIST?
Oh, sure. Yep. We've actually used sorafenib a fair bit, particularly during the time prior to regorafenib's availability and before we had regorafenib participating in developing trials. So certainly some patients do benefit from sorafenib. And I think that the data that's been presented in the phase two trials has been supported in what we've seen in clinic.
So just in July in the JCO, you had a paper looking at regorafenib, and of course, there was a phase three study presented at ASCO by your colleague, Dr. Dimitri, and I see your 47-year-old man looks like was on the same study that you just published, I think.
Yes.
So maybe you can present him, and that'll kind of lead us into the trial.
Sure. So this is a 47-year-old gentleman with a diagnosis of metastatic GIST. His primary metastases have been within the peritoneum. He does not have visceral disease. He was treated initially with imatinib for 3 years with excellent disease control, but developed multifocal progression within the peritoneum.
Could I just ask you, when you say within the peritoneum, did he actually have ascites?
No, he had soft tissue masses within the abdominal cavity.
And did they cause him symptoms?
No, it was picked up by imaging initially.
Hmm.
And that's a pretty common presentation of somebody with metastatic GIST. Certainly visceral disease and liver mets are common as well, but peritoneal recurrences are very common in GIST.
How did he do, before you go on, during the 3 years he was on imatinib, any major problems with side effects?
No, he tolerated it really well. I mean, works full time, has a busy family life, very active in terms of his day-to-day activities. He's a young family, so was very active keeping up with his family. Did really well. He had a brief period of dose escalation. His initial imatinib dose was a standard dose of 400 milligrams per day, and then his dose was escalated from 400 to 800. And that's based on some data that suggests that a subset of patients, maybe 30% of patients, will gain a benefit from that dose escalation. Although the challenge with dose escalation of imatinib is that clearly toxicity is higher, and the durability of that benefit is often limited when one looks at the studies in aggregate. So he went ahead and had a higher dose of imatinib. The disease continued to progress, and so he then was transitioned to sunitinib, and he tolerated this well and remained on drug for about a year and a half.
Just out of curiosity, did he have hypertension?
On sunitinib, he did not.
Hmm. Did he have an objective response or just stable disease?
Stable disease.
But he was asymptomatic.
Asymptomatic at that time. When he developed his progression, however, he did become symptomatic because one of the lesions in the peritoneum actually ended up eroding through and involving a rib. So that became very uncomfortable for him.
Hmm. Just out of curiosity, I know there's a lot of translational work obviously going on your place. Did he have any molecular studies of particular note or interest, mutation studies?
So he has a primary exon 11 mutation. Exon 11 mutations are the most common mutation that we see in GIST, very imatinib sensitive. His secondary mutation, which became apparent as part of the surgical procedure that was done at one point, actually showed a resistance mutation in exon 17, which is a mutation which is known to be sunitinib resistant. But again, we have to think about these secondary mutations with a little bit of caution, because what we find in one lesion may not be reflective of what is occurring across the entire tumor and certainly within an individual.
So when he had these symptoms, it was mainly the rib pain?
Yeah, rib pain.
Did you consider or did you radiate him?
No, that's at the point that he developed progressive disease. So we, at that point, discussed options, and that's when he went on the regorafenib trial.
Out of curiosity, if he hadn't gone on the trial, what would you have likely done?
Well, it would have depended what other trials we had available. Trials are always our first line option in patients with sunitinib-resistant GIST because there is, we hope, you know, regorafenib is going through the process for consideration of approval, but at this point, we had no other approved therapy, so we would consider trials, whether it be another kinase inhibitor, phase ones. Outside of a trial, we would have discussed sorafenib based on those phase two studies that had previously been presented, and that would have been the primary issues. We may have also discussed consideration, and we did actually discuss all these options. We also discussed consideration of surgical resection, particularly of the symptomatic lesion, and the ultimate decision was to move forward with change in systemic therapy.
Do you consider GIST radio resistant, quote?
So, you know, historically, back, if you look at the old studies of GIST with regard to radiation, the feeling was that, yes, it was, quote unquote, radio resistant. And I would say that our systemic therapies for GIST have gotten so much better than they used to be that the role of radiation really has not played a front and center role. The area that we have used radiation successfully is in the rare patients who develop symptomatic bony metastases, then radiation has been helpful in the clinical management of that group of patients. But otherwise, it would be unusual for us to integrate radiation into a treatment plan.
Just another side point. How often, if ever, do you see brain mets in GIST, and what do you do about it?
It's extremely, extremely rare. We actually just published a case report in JCO earlier this year of a young man who had developed a brain metastasis. And the number of reported brain mets in GIST is a handful. If in the rare situation that it does happen, we would treat it as a standard approach to a metastasis. If it's solitary and can be resected, then we resect it. If it's not, then radiation is considered as a palliative measure. But it's an extremely uncommon, rare event.
So he goes on this phase two trial. Obviously, he got the drug. And I think your report was, what, in 33 or 35 patients in this study?
Yes, we had 33 patients treated, yep.
And what happened to him?
He did great. So he had stable disease. He did have some bidimensional shrinkage, but by RECIST, it did not meet a formal PR, which was very common in the population that we saw. He had symptomatic improvement of his lesion, and he initially tolerated full-dose regorafenib quite well. But by his second, even within his second or third cycle, he started to have challenges with toxicity, which for him included development of hypertension, challenges with diarrhea, and fatigue. And because of those, we ultimately reduced his dose from the standard starting dose of 160 milligrams per day. It's days 1 through 21 with a 7-day washout to follow. But he went from 160 milligrams to 120 milligrams and has done very well at that dose level.
It's kind of interesting that you had to dose adjust them on regorafenib, but you didn't mention doing that with sunitinib.
No, he did okay at sunitinib. We treated him at the 37.5 milligrams daily, the continuous daily dose, and he tolerated that very well. You know, we've seen in both the phase two and the phase three trials of regorafenib that a fair number of patients require dose reductions. And the study really encouraged people to dose reduce in order to maintain exposure and not to feel as though you needed to push patients through if they were having significant toxicity.
Yeah, when we had this GI cancer think tank that Charlie Fuchs was at, another person there was Axel Grothy, and of course he's done a lot of work with regorafenib and colon cancer, and he was saying that he felt like a lot of patients required dose adjustment, but that a lot of patients could be gotten on a dose where they had tumor efficacy and were pretty comfortable.
Absolutely.
Is that what you would say about GIST?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's really an important point about this drug, which is that to dose reduce doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to sacrifice efficacy. And so it's important to get people on a dose that they are able to tolerate so that you can determine whether the efficacy is there for that patient.
So maybe you can summarize what we know right now, what you reported in terms of these 33 patients in the phase two trial, what was reported with the phase three GRID study. And actually, when you were mentioning the fact that this patient had some minimal tumor shrinkage, I was trying to remember if I've seen any waterfall plots with regorafenib and GIST.
Yes, we do have a waterfall plot for regorafenib and GIST, and what we experienced. So let me build that into the summary. So in the phase two trial, we treated 33 patients. The median progression-free survival on that study was 10 months, which compared to other phase two experiences was, not that we can compare phase two experiences, but was a very good hypothesis generating PFS. When looking at clinical benefit, and for the study, we define clinical benefit as resist CR, PR, or stable disease for greater than 16 weeks, we had a clinical benefit rate of about 80% in our population. When we looked at response or disease control by primary genotype KIT mutation status, we looked at folks with exon 11, exon 9, and patients who are traditionally considered quote-unquote wild-type GIST, meaning no identifiable mutation in KIT or PDGF receptor. There appeared to be benefit across all three subsets. Those in the phase 2 trial, the PFS for the exon 9 patients was less than the exon 11 patients, but there were only three patients in that group, so it's difficult to make any conclusions about those folks. So we felt that based on the phase 2 trial, the degree of disease control that we had, the PFS that was seen, modifications in dose were required in about 80% of patients, but yet there was not significant need to discontinue the regorafenib because of toxicity. So people were able to stay on it despite, you know, they needed modification in their dose, but they were able to stay on it quite well. And so based on all of the data from the phase 2 trial, the phase 3 trial moved forward. It accrued rapidly. International phase 3 trial, 85 sites, accrued in 7 months. It was designed as a 2-to-1 randomization regorafenib to placebo. And that data, as you mentioned, was presented at ASCO this year by George Dimitri. And there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival for patients who received regorafenib compared to placebo, with the mean PFS of the regorafenib group at about 5 months and the median PFS of the placebo group at just under a month. It was 0.9 months.
And it kind of ties into what you're saying about your phase 2 trial, that these people don't seem to do too well.
When you take them off study?
No, if they don't get treatment, I mean, you're thinking about your 47-year-old man.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, in the control group of the phase 3 study, the progression-free survival is less than a month.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, if you go back and look at the phase 3 trial of sunitinib, which was also a placebo-controlled trial, the control arm in that group, the placebo arm, median progression-free survival was 6 weeks. So it is a population where without kinase inhibition, one can see pretty significant progression over short periods of time.
And I guess the phase 3 had a crossover.
It did have a crossover. Patients who were on placebo were allowed to cross over to regorafenib at the time of disease progression. And it appeared when you looked at the PFS curves post crossover, the disease control appeared just as good as if you had been on regorafenib to begin with. So there didn't appear to be a detriment to that short period of time the patients were on placebo. And if one looks at the overall survival, there was no difference between the folks randomized to regorafenib compared to those randomized to placebo. And that was expected because of the crossover arm.
Right, although it actually looked like there was a little bit of a survival bump even with the crossover.
Yeah, but nothing that met statistical significance.
Right. It was just the curves. So, you know, with these kinds of data, you would think that if it were available and that it probably would become available, that it wouldn't be much of a problem figuring out what to do in a patient progressing on imatinib and sunitinib. But if it were available and you could be more liberal about where you would use it, would you still use it after both or maybe before sunitinib?
So it's a good question. I mean, I think right now, if the drug becomes available, which we're all hopeful that it will, I think its role will be as third line. That's really where the data has been right now. I think it's a question that's come up as to whether or not there's an opportunity to test it earlier on. I think some of the challenges, as with sunitinib, are going to be toxicity management, dose modification management, and ensuring that patients can remain on the drug, well-controlled, well-tolerated for extended periods of time. But I do think it's an interesting drug to consider and would be interesting to compare to sunitinib earlier on.
And in terms of other strategies, you know, it's almost like the disease is sort of tempting us. You know, it's so responsive and yet not curable. What is the thinking now in terms of how to make that next leap? Is there any thought about combination biologics?
Yes, for sure. And there are a number of studies ongoing looking at kinase inhibitors plus other therapies that are not necessarily KIT-directed therapies. So for example, there are ongoing studies looking at KIT inhibitors, imatinib, plus HSP90 inhibitors. And there has been some previous work looking at imatinib plus mTOR inhibition, and that will likely continue to be built on in ways that we can hopefully increase the degree of mTOR inhibition. The study that was done a number of years ago was imatinib plus everolimus, but the dose of everolimus in that study was quite low. It was only 2.5 milligrams per day. So I think that there's an opportunity to try agents either at higher doses or further trying to harness really that PI3 kinase mTOR pathway. And those studies are certainly ongoing. There's a PI3 kinase study that's being done as well. So I think combination is certainly an area that people are very interested in.
So let's talk a little bit about adjuvant treatment. And actually, if we could, I'd like to go to your second case. 19-year-old, pretty young person there. What happened?
So this was a 19-year-old who presented unexpectedly with a major GI bleed. She had an EGD that confirmed a large gastric mass that was ulcerating in the stomach. There was no evidence of distant metastatic disease. A CT-guided biopsy was performed, which showed GIST. The decision at that point was, what should we do? Should we give preoperative imatinib? Should we take her to surgery? How do we approach this? And this case, I think, brings up a couple issues. It brings up the issues of adjuvant therapy and perioperative management of localized disease, and it also brings up the issue of a very unique subtype of GIST that we're learning a lot more about called SDH-deficient GIST. But before we go into those subtleties, I'll tell you what happened to her. So there was discussion about whether or not to take the tumor out or try to treat it with imatinib up front, but she rebled. And so the decision was to take her to the operating room. She had surgery. The final path revealed a 13-centimeter mixed epithelioid and spindle cell GIST with a what would be considered a high number of mitoses. And then the questions became, what do we do? Do we give her adjuvant imatinib? Do we observe? How do we think about this? Not only with regard to the adjuvant data that's available, but also in light of the emerging understanding of SDH-deficient GIST.
So maybe we can backtrack a little bit, comment a little bit about the age distribution of GIST.
So the majority of GIST, the median age of a patient with GIST is about 60 years old, 50 to 60. But we clearly see GIST across the age spectrum, from pediatrics into the elderly years. We know that in the younger patients, where GIST is uncommon but certainly can occur, the natural history of the disease can be somewhat different than patients who are diagnosed in the adult years. And we also know from previous studies that younger patients are less likely to have an objective response, meaning tumor shrinkage to imatinib, and that at times, younger patients' tumors clinically will be very indolent in their behavior. They tend to metastasize very frequently, but they may grow very slowly. So clinically, there are some distinctions between typical adult GIST and what was originally called pediatric GIST, these GISTs in younger people. And then biologically, we've come to understand that there are some differences. Whereas the majority of adult GISTs are characterized by gain-of-function mutations in KIT, in kids, the majority of cases have no identifiable mutation in KIT and are characterized as wild-type GIST. No mutation in KIT, no mutation in PDGF receptor. People have also looked at other mutations, BRAF, that have been found sporadically in GIST, but this does not tend to occur in this subtype. We've also learned that pathologically and histologically, the tumors in pediatrics, in this typical pediatric wild-type population, they look slightly different under the microscope. And what's become apparent over the past year or so is that these tumors, rather than being characterized by gain-of-function mutations in GIST, seem to be characterized by loss of an SDH subunit, so succinate dehydrogenase deficiency. And what you can see is that these patients may have loss of SDHB or they may have loss of SDHA in the tumor itself. And so what was historically called pediatric wild-type GIST is now being called SDH-deficient GIST because it has this unique histology. It likely has a very unique biology. It has a unique natural history, and the response to kinase inhibitors is likely different than one would consider for typical KIT mutant GIST.
What is SDH, and sort of biologically, how do you conceptualize the tumor then?
So SDH is a part of the Krebs cycle and the metabolism of the tumor cell. Exactly how SDH deficiency is associated with the biology of GIST in this subset, we don't know. This is an area that's really been only reported in this population over the last year or year and a half. So this is an area of really active investigation. There are some very rare syndromes, something called Carney's triad and Carney's Stratakis dyad, that have connection between the development of GIST and paraganglioma. And there are hereditary syndromes of paraganglioma that are characterized by SDH deficiency. So folks are now trying to really understand how SDH deficiency relates to the oncologic potential of GIST, either within one of these syndromes or outside of a syndrome.
Now, normally, are there cases that occur in older people, and do you actually get the diagnosis when you send for typical mutation testing, or you have to do special testing?
In terms of SDH deficiency?
Yeah.
So in terms of older people, there was actually a nice study through the AFIP before it disbanded by Dr. Mietinen, who's one of the pathologists who has this huge experience of GIST. And he looked at all. So the other thing about SDH deficient GIST is that they only occur in the stomach. They don't occur in the small bowel or in the peritoneum. Their primaries always start in the stomach. So he went back and looked at a whole series of hundreds of gastric GISTs across the age spectrum. And if you look, people under 20, about 90% of them had this characteristic, this SDH deficient GIST. People over 40, the percentage of patients with SDH deficient GIST is extremely small. It does happen, but it's extremely small. The vast majority are KIT mutant. So to get back to your question, how do you know if you have this? This is an area which is really just emerging. Our pathologists have a paper that they've presented and is coming out in press that describes sort of what the pathologists need to be able to look out for when they look at a GIST in terms of the morphology. And it's also a tumor that immunohistochemistry can be performed, and that's also been reported by several groups to help understand SDH deficiency. If you send the tumor for typical genotype, then if it's done as thorough genotyping, what you should find is that it's wild type for KIT, wild type for PDGF receptor, so that you're not finding a mutation in any of these subtypes. And then if you find a wild type GIST, then the next question is to go back to the pathologist to say, is this an SDH deficient wild type? Maybe not all wild type are SDH deficient. There likely are subsets. But SDH deficiency, the beginnings of thinking about it are related to the way it looks morphologically as well as having a wild type mutational analysis.
So it sounds like you're not going to have a lot of data to go on here in terms of trying to figure out what to do in terms of adjuvant treatment, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but what do we know about it and what did you actually do?
So what we know about it is there have been two trials looking at adjuvant therapy in GIST, two large trials. One was the ACASOG Z9000 trial, which randomized patients to either a year of adjuvant imatinib or placebo, and the other was the SSGS study, a Scandinavian study that randomized patients to either 1 year or 3 years of imatinib, recently published, the Z9001 trial. That study actually showed a recurrence-free survival benefit when looking at 1 year of imatinib compared to placebo, and that included any patients with a tumor size over 3 centimeters. There was no difference in overall survival, but the follow-up was rather short. In their subset analysis of that study, they looked at a couple different features. One thing that they looked at was tumor size, and people that had the larger tumors, so tumors over 10 centimeters, had the biggest benefit with regard to recurrence-free survival. Folks with smallest tumors had a much smaller differential in the curves.
Was the relative risk reduction similar?
Good question. You know, I actually don't know the answer to that, but I believe that the relative risk reduction remained highest in those with the largest tumors.
Interesting.
And because of that, even after that study, really the consensus both from the U.S. groups as well as European groups is that the consideration of adjuvant imatinib is really for those with intermediate and highest risk tumors. Low risk tumors, although the FDA label is very broad, low risk tumors, traditionally we would not recommend adjuvant imatinib. But back to this case, in the Z9001 trial, they also looked at genotype. So they looked at patients with exon 11 mutations, exon 9 mutations, and wild type. At the time that these studies were done, they couldn't parse out SDH deficiency. But folks with wild type tumors did not seem to gain as clear of a benefit from adjuvant imatinib as those folks with KIT mutant GIST.
And would you guess that most of those were SDH patients?
Hard to know. I think we really are still learning that. My guess is probably, but I don't know. And historically, we also know that patients with SDH deficient GIST, although I certainly treat them with imatinib if they have metastatic disease, their tumors tend not to shrink. And so for the reasons where the Z9001 study did not show a clear benefit with wild type in the adjuvant setting, and as well as understanding this as a different, distinct biology, we, for this particular patient, opted not to treat her with adjuvant imatinib. But I think it's really important that we distinguish that if this person was 49 and had KIT mutant GIST, then she would clearly have met criteria for benefit from adjuvant imatinib. And so I want to be sure the message is not that you shouldn't give adjuvant imatinib, but really rather to understand this unique subset and that they may have a different expectation for biology. Whereas the vast majority of patients with GIST in this situation will indeed have a mutation in KIT and likely will benefit from adjuvant therapy.
And I actually wanted to kind of pick that up a little bit and get into it a little more, but just to follow up on this patient, how long has it been now since the surgery and what's her situation?
I actually saw this person just this week and is now 3 years out from surgery, remains without any evidence of disease.
Great.
Yep.
So getting back to the more common situation that you were talking about, again, at this think tank, we were talking about this issue of what's the bar to treat. And, you know, oncologists come out of a culture that I think started with breast cancer of numeracy in adjuvant therapy, you know, adjuvant online, all the numbers, et cetera. And seems a little bit more recent that this has come up in colon cancer and actually in GIST. And first I'd ask, do you think it's appropriate when you have a patient who's status post-surgery to plug the patient into a nomogram? And if so, which one?
There are a number of different risk stratification systems within GIST. There's the NIH criteria, there's what's called modified NIH criteria, and then Memorial Sloan Kettering, as you alluded to, has a nomogram that you can plug in and it will spit out a number that they think the likelihood that the disease will come back. I certainly think that it's appropriate in patients with resected GIST to gather some sense of risk stratification. And I think that that's important because in the Scandinavian study of adjuvant imatinib, that study did demonstrate an overall survival benefit for the population of patients that were treated. That included patients that were what's called the modified NIH criteria, high risk by the modified NIH criteria, so tumor size greater than 10 centimeters, mitosis greater than 10 per 50, we can talk about that a little bit, or greater than 5 centimeters and greater than 5 mitoses. It also included ruptured tumors as well. That study took these high-risk patients and randomized them to either 1 year of postoperative imatinib or 3 years of postoperative imatinib. And that study did demonstrate an overall survival benefit for those folks randomized to the longer duration of therapy. And because this was the first study that shown an overall survival benefit in adjuvant therapy for GIST, despite all the, you know, we could talk about the design and all kinds of things, it did show an overall survival benefit. I think it's important that in a patient that's had a resected GIST, that we understand they may fall into the category of patients that would be considered high risk and potentially benefit from adjuvant therapy.
So again, getting back to nomograms, because one of the things that I've heard people say is, you know, the average oncologist in practice might not be aware of all the refineties in identifying risk. And another that I wanted to ask you about is location. How does that affect risk?
So those are two questions. So in terms of the location, we know that gastric tumors tend to do better than small bowel tumors. So a large gastric tumor with a low mitotic rate would have a lower risk of recurrence than a tumor with the same features that was in the small bowel. So it is important that one consider location, size, and mitoses. Those are the three factors that go into really all of the risk stratification systems that are out there. What I do is there is the NIH criteria. There's actually a great table from a paper from Mietinen's group, and I tend to use that as my guide for risk. And patients that are intermediate or high risk, certainly high risk patients, I would typically recommend adjuvant imatinib. Patients that are in the intermediate risk, those are the ones that we have a long discussion about. And low risk patients are those that I don't. The Memorial Sloan Kettering nomogram will spit out a number. Some people use that. Chuck Blanke, who did the discussion at ASCO 2 years ago on this abstract, proposed that anybody with a greater than 50% chance of recurrence be considered for adjuvant imatinib. Certainly, that's reasonable to consider, but I don't think we yet have a consensus. Most people will say intermediate or high risk.
And of course, the issue of duration is out there, as you mentioned, and I'm hearing a lot of people question whether to stop at 3 years.
Right. And I think that, you know, if you look at the curves from the Scandinavian study as they were published, the authors did an interesting analysis where they looked at the time that people were on drug versus the time people were off drug. And the benefit with regard to recurrence really seemed to be during that period of time that the 3 year folks were on drug, that the 1 year folks were off drug. What we consistently see in the EGASOG trial, which was just 1 year, and the Scandinavian study is that people do well when they're on the drug. When they come off the drug, they continue to do well for a period of whether it's a year or 2 years, but then the curves again decline with recurrences. So although the Scandinavian study did show a survival benefit, which implies that maybe some people are doing even better, the risk of recurrence tends to reemerge the longer people are off the adjuvant therapy. We haven't seen a plateau of those curves after adjuvant therapy is discontinued. And that continues to raise this debate of, well, how long do we continue on? And there is a study that completed accrual as a single-arm phase 2 study, high-risk patients only, of 5 years of imatinib. So that will be interesting to see what happens to those folks. But the question of whether 3 years is enough is really one that I think we'll continue to discuss and debate.
What about the question of whether or not someone might do just as well waiting until the relapse and then getting the imatinib? I don't know, in the Scandinavian study, I'm assuming most or almost all those patients got imatinib on relapse?
Yes.
So I guess that would be pretty evidential with a survival benefit.
Right. And I think that was really one of the challenges. And, you know, when that study was being looked at, that was one of the questions that was asked, which was, well, what did you do with these people when they recurred? And patients did go back on imatinib. And, you know, I think because of the Scandinavian study showing these patients at high risk having a survival benefit, I think that that's really become a standard recommendation for high-risk patients postoperatively.
So I took another look at the NCCN guidelines again that you're part of, and I'm going to say maybe you all ought to think about making it a little more straightforward, because it's kind of hard to sort of dig out exactly what to do there. And
yes,
it's not too hard to figure out what to do if you have a high-risk patient that could have gone on the Scandinavian trial, but it's real hard to figure out people below that bar, and particularly because there's a trial out there of the 1 year versus not.
Yeah.
You know, you think about, again, thinking about breast cancer, endocrine therapy is given for very, very minor benefits because it's considered fairly non-toxic. Imatinib may not be like endocrine therapy, but it's also not like chemo.
Right.
And you wonder if first of all, do we know that patients who are low risk might not have some borderline benefit?
So it's a good point. I mean, I think you're not the first person that has raised the issue of how complicated these guidelines have become in sarcoma. And I think part of that is due to some of the lack of good answers we have. And I think a lot of it's reflective of different people's opinion in an area where it would be great to have more definitive data. But with that said, you know, I think in the Scandinavian study, about a quarter of patients randomized to the 3 year arm stopped treatment, not because of tumor recurrence, but for some other reason. And so it does raise the issue of tolerance, that although imatinib is well tolerated, there was a non-trivial discontinuation rate in that study. So toxicity, although again, certainly isn't chemo, but fatigue can occur for people. Diarrhea, chronic diarrhea can be an issue for people. Muscle cramping can be an issue for people. And so in the lowest risk patients, I think that it's very difficult to, I think the field in general, you know, it's difficult to justify extended therapy for low risk people. I think it's really the intermediate patients that things become more muddy. And that's where I think there's more controversy or lack of consensus.
So let's finish up talking about your 52-year-old patient, kind of an unusual situation here. I'm curious what you actually did. Maybe you can just briefly talk about him.
Sure. So he's a 52-year-old gentleman. He has metastatic GIST, treated with imatinib, had a great response, and all disease is in a distribution that's resectable. So he, again, is a gentleman that had peritoneal disease. And even if he had a small liver metastasis that was peripheral, wouldn't really change the clinical scenario. And the issue becomes, well, what do you do in that situation? You know, GIST is a disease that historically was always treated with surgery. It was a surgically managed disease prior to the year 2000 because there were no systemic therapies that helped. And then with the advent of these drugs that have revolutionized how we treat the disease, people have now started to go, well, not now, but over the last several years have gone back to say, well, gee, you know, is there a role for surgery? We know imatinib doesn't cure people of this disease, although there's a subset of people that may do well for a very long time. The majority of patients will ultimately develop disease progression. And we know that that disease progression can occur because of resistance, appears to be characterized by resistance mutations. So the question has been, well, what if we remove those lesions that are present at a time when they're under good control? Would that be helpful?
Just out of curiosity, was the disease resectable initially?
The disease could have been resected, but it would have been a big operation.
So you think it would be a different operation because of the response?
Yes.
Hmm.
It would have been a different operation because of the response. So what do we know? So we know that there have been several retrospective series looking at surgery in patients with metastatic GIST in the area of kinase inhibition. And those studies consistently have shown that patients with resectable metastatic disease on a kinase inhibitor, we'll say on imatinib, that undergo surgery and all disease is removed, seem to do quite well. Patients who undergo resection of metastatic disease on imatinib at a time when that metastatic disease is all growing, generalized progression we call it, tend not to do well at all. You take the tumors out, then they grow right back, even if you keep them on the kinase inhibitor. Patients in the middle, we call it limited progression. So you might have one or two sites of disease that are growing. Everything else is stable. They do in the middle. You know, they sort of have a middle of the road. The challenge with this first group, the people that are doing well, you take out their disease and they do well, is what we don't know is whether the surgery contributed to their continued disease control or whether you took a group of people that were doing well and then they just continued to do well. There was attempts to do a randomized trial of this in Europe. It closed due to challenges with accrual. But I think that the question in the field is debulking measurable disease valuable because in some way you're reducing the amount of tumor available to develop resistance? And because several studies have shown that people seem to do well when they undergo resection of well-controlled metastatic disease, that is an area that we consider. What we also know, though, is there was a study from Germany that even in that group of people with well-controlled disease, if you do their operation and you stop their imatinib, the tumors grow back because the imatinib is clearly providing suppression to microscopic disease. So surgery is not an alternative to systemic kinase inhibition in metastatic GIST. But the question is it an adjunct? Is it another therapy that we can add on? And what we've tended to do is that we have this conversation with patients. We let them know the data that's out there, that we can't prove that it's necessarily beneficial, but that we think that people may do well. And we weigh that against the challenges and the risks of the surgery involved. And in people with readily resectable, well-controlled metastatic disease, that may not be considered high risk for surgery. Those people may go on to have surgical resection performed. And in people where the surgical resection is felt to be quite high risk with either large hepatic resections or things that would lead to challenges with function and bowel function or otherwise, we don't push surgery in that area because we don't have the data to support that risk.
So neoadjuvant therapy of metastatic disease. Not sure I've heard that one too often. What happened with this patient?
This patient, we actually did go on to resect, and he remains without any evidence of disease now several years after surgery and still on imatinib. But again, you know, I think it's important to emphasize that he may have been one of those patients that would have done well even without surgery.
And this surgery that he had, I assume there wasn't any bowel resection. It was just lopping off these metastatic deposits?
He did have a couple of small sections of small bowel removed, but nothing that was function altering.
So I'm sorry we didn't get enough time to talk about sarcomas and other sarcomas, but maybe we can do that another time. I did have one final question I want to ask you. I wanted to ask you before, but I closed by asking you this. Getting back to this issue of duration of adjuvant imatinib, do you have people who've been on 5, you know, 8, 10 years?
Adjuvantly?
Yes.
I don't have anybody that's been on 8 or 10 years. I do have a couple people that have been on certainly more than 3 years. And in my own practice, those are people who had marginal resections at the outset of high-risk tumors. And so I felt that their risks were not only due to the characteristics of the tumor, but may have been further compounded by the type of surgery that was able to be performed due to the anatomy.
Maybe I can ask you this another way, because I guess the data is sort of catching up to us here. But in a patient who's tolerating the drug well and, you know, getting it paid for, what's kind of the longest you think you'd want to, at this point? I mean, hopefully you'll have more data, but at this point, when would you sort of arbitrarily stop, if at all?
Well, you know, I think when I start people now, I aim for 3 years because that's where the data are. And then at that point, then we reassess. We want to see where the data are 3 years from now. And then, you know, I have a conversation with the patient and try to make the best decision that we can with that particular patient based on their characteristics.